This is the Adventure Sports Podcast, brought to you by 180 TAC. Get out there and have some fun. Episode 180, Chris Warren, Professional Mountaineer. Happy Independence Day to you this wonderful July 4th, 2016. This is a day to celebrate our freedoms, and we have an amazing show coming up for you, but I want you to take a moment today. Think about three things: liberty, freedom, opportunity. Liberty, freedom, opportunity. For me, that's what Independence Day is all about. And one more thought for the day. Please ponder this one. It applies to adventure sports and a lot of other aspects in life. The one who would sacrifice freedom on the altar of security will have neither. The one who would sacrifice freedom on the altar of security will have neither. So anyway, happy Independence Day, and now on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Adventure Sports Podcast. This is your host, Kurt Linville. Today I have an amazing international climber with us, Chris Warner, who is here to tell us all about high altitude climbing expeditions. He's been teaching climbing since 1983, and he's been an international climber since 1987. He's led over 200 international expeditions. He's summited over 120 times on peaks over 19,000 feet. I don't think there are many people on the planet that can claim that one, Chris. That's pretty amazing. He was the first American to solo an 8,000-meter peak, and he has summited five of the eight 8,000-meter peaks, including Everest, Amont du Blanc, Lhotse K2, some others. Chris, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks, Kurt. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's an honor for us to have you on the show. We're really excited to kind of sort out what climbing is about and why climb, which really, I'm gonna dive right into that. Why climb a mountain? What is your answer to that?
Well, I think for me, it was the whole romance of it, you know, caught up in, as a kid, and just reading these books about famous explorers, just people doing really, really cool things. And, you know, I was born in the 60s, so was in kindergarten when man first walked on the moon. I actually got to spend this morning with an astronaut. That was pretty cool.
And, wow.
Yeah, so I just have always been caught up in that whole idea that you can have a challenge that would demand the absolute best in you, and as a result of, you know, the best in you coming out, that you realize you are, you know, you're capable of some pretty cool things. So mountaineering was a perfect test for me, as it is for a lot of other people. You know, like, do I have the mental, you know, capacity and the intellectual endurance and the physical strength to be able to get up and down a mountain alive? And, you know, the cool thing about those adventures is when you get to the top of one peak, you just see more and more and more, and kind of you just see an endless, you know, series of challenges that await you. And mountaineering is another cool aspect of it that I think things like, you know, like that some other adventure sports don't have, or more endurance sports don't have. It's just a sense of adventure. It goes on a longer scale. So like when we were on K2 the last time, we were there for 89 days. And so, you know, it's a big, huge chunk of your life, and you have these very complex relationships that exist during the course of the expedition, not just with your friends and, you know, your climbing partners, but with, you know, the people who live in the area, the people you hire as, you know, base camp staff, et cetera, and then all the other expeditions on the mountain. So it's, I guess it supplied me like an endless supply of these little narrative adventures that I get to go on, and each time hopefully come back, you know, a better person for having endured all of that stuff.
Yeah. You know, that's an excellent answer. We often ask people, why adventure? You know, what is there in it? What's the point? And man, what you just outlined, the overall life challenge, finding out kind of what you're made of, learning more about yourself, but then also it's the community aspect of it, getting to know people on a really intimate level in some very challenging situations.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, like sometimes you see, you know, displays of heroism and altruism, and sometimes you see displays of narcissism and selfishness, and so you really get to see, you know, like the best and the worst of people.
I just had a great idea. I think that we should start a service where we take people on a challenging climb who are considering getting married.
Oh yeah.
I mean, think about it. Because these sorts of situations draw out the reality of people. You can't fake it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's been done in outdoor education already. That's why they invented canoeing and tandem bicycling. Yeah.
Yep, of course. So how did you get into climbing? What's the first story?
Yeah, so when I was in high school, our school did field trips for kids who weren't so interested in learning. And I was invited to go on one of those field trips. And, you know, the purpose was to kick the crap out of me and turn me into a normal human being. And I went out there, and instead of suffering, I actually loved every single second of it. We went rock climbing, we went orienteering, you know, we were backpacking for 5 days and living underneath a plastic tarp in the woods. And I just thought it was the greatest thing ever. And having grown up outside of New York City, I was completely unaware that this world existed. And I met these outdoor instructors, and, you know, I remember them. You know, even though this is 37 years ago, I remember them like it was yesterday. And, you know, Joe Thomas was a kid from Somerville, Mass. And Rachel Holdsworth was a mountaineering guide from Alaska. And, you know, they decided that they wanted to spend their life putting people in these life-enriching experiences, you know, using the outdoors to challenge them to be better people. And I bought that idea, you know, hook, line, and sinker. So by the time I was 15, when I went on that trip, by the time I was 17, I was working for that same outdoor program, and I've been doing the same thing ever since.
How fun is that? It's amazing to me when I get to visit with someone like yourself who has made a lifetime, a career, and a passion out of something that they love.
Yeah.
Man, what a gift is that?
Yeah, and it comes with sacrifice, of course, right, Kurt? So, you know, even when I started EarthTrex, the first 10 years I made $19,000 a year, you know, reinvested every penny back in the business. And, you know, that comes at a cost, right? You know, as a business person, I have taught leadership at the Wharton School of Business for 16 years. So I'm a little bit of a business wonk. And, you know, they would call that an opportunity cost. I could have been an accountant like my father, and I could have made a lot more money during that time period. But I chose, you know, this other path instead. And I think in the long run, you know, happiness-wise, I came out way ahead. Financially-wise, I'm not quite sure how that would have, you know, sorted itself out, but I'm content.
So you mentioned EarthTrex. You have 4 climbing centers now, is that right?
Well, we'll have our 5th in about a month. So we're opening a gigantic one right next to Washington, D.C.
Wow. So where are these located?
Well, we opened our first one in 1997 in Columbia, Maryland. Our second in 2002 in Timonium, Maryland. So these are suburbs of Baltimore. In 2005 into 2006, we opened up one in Rockville, Maryland. The Golden Colorado gym we opened in 2013. And then this new Crystal City, Virginia gym will be open in 2016.
Right on. So it sounds like it was a lot of sacrifice to get everything rolling, but things are really rolling now.
Yeah, and that, I'll tell you, that is not because of talent. That is because of the wind being at our back. I mean, when I first started climbing, you know, it was for, you know, ne'er-do-wells and juvenile delinquents when climbing. Now, literally, your daughter is a climber.
Sure.
So, you know, it's just completely, you know, you would have kept your daughter away from climbers 30 years ago because they were the, you know, the real, you know, rag a muffin dudes.
It's where the term dirtbags comes from, right?
Yes, yes. So, you know, it's just a completely different world now. And I've been lucky enough, and EarthTrex has been lucky enough to just be kind of standing in the right place, and then the wind hit us and kept blowing us along. So no matter how terrible we ever were, like, that, you know, we were just carried towards where we are today.
Cool story.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what it's like to be on a really big peak. You know, I've climbed a lot of 14ers, but I've not managed to break 15 yet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I climb for my reasons, but what's it like to do one of these 6, 7, 8,000 meter giants?
Well, I think that's a complex question, and it's, I'd say a lot of the things have changed over the course of my career as a mountaineer. So the first time, as you said, I went international climbing was 1987. I went down to Peru, and there just wasn't that many people down there. and you just could kind of do whatever you wanted to do, which was super cool. And in that era, we didn't judge people on whether or not they summited, but on the style in which they climbed the peak. So, you know, yeah, great that you climbed Everest, but really, really great if you climbed Everest by a new route. And, you know, the seven summits idea didn't exist back then. And I always felt that that was kind of the good thing about, you know, the 80s and before that in climbing was climbers are really doing it for internal reasons. There was no fame or fortune involved at all.
Sure.
And as a result of that, you only did it because it pleased something inside your own soul. And I think really with the beginning, you know, I might sound, I don't know, like an old has-been or something right now, but I think when they invented things like the seven summits or the 14 8,000-meter peaks, it created a different yardstick to judge people's success by in climbing. And adventure was less important than tagging the top.
Mm.
And I lived through that. I guided Everest in 2000, 2001, and 2003. And in 2003, I guided the first ever reality TV show on Everest. So if you want to find a person who put the nail in the coffin, you know, I definitely am one of those people that are guilty of that. So when you go to Everest today, or, you know, even a Makalu or one of these other peaks, it's just, there is just so many more people there. And, you know, we really saw, like in 2001, somebody from my group was the 2,000th person to reach the summit of Everest.
Wow.
So it took, you know, over 40 years for the first two people to make it. And then 48 years later, there was, you know, 1,998 more people summited the mountain. And that day was the record summit day in Everest at the time. There's 89 people on the top. So when you stand on the top of Mount Everest with 89 other people, it's like being in a subway car in New York, except everybody's got, you know, down jackets on. You know, the view is really cool, right? But you only see the view if you look away from the crowd. And there was an article written after that expedition using our summit picture as a cover photo, and it was a National Geographic Adventure, and it was entitled The Everest Mess. And the mess that they were talking about was not stuff like oxygen bottles and, you know, garbage left behind, but they're really talking about human behaviors that were happening up there. And, you know, I think to me, the saddest part was people going inside of the other people's, you know, sleeping in their sleeping bags, using their oxygen bottles, eating their food, et cetera, just doing whatever it takes to sneak up to the summit of Mount Everest and not being concerned with the style in which they climbed it. And we've always had a saying, don't reach the peak, but miss the point.
Good point.
And I think this is a very, the more I look at this, this is a very American outdoor philosophy. And I'm sure it's shared by lots of individuals around the world and other cultures as well. But, you know, this is something that we see as being critically important as outdoor adventurers, that not only do we reach the summit, but we climbed it in a style that we are going to be proud of forever. We have this, you know, philosophical belief that pursuing giant goals makes us a better person. And that's something we really have to make sure that we keep central to our, you know, wilderness ethos in the United States, because it really is something that makes it special, you know, kind of that, the American outdoor experience.
Oh yeah. You know, the 14ers kind of as a microcosm of what you're talking about. I quit climbing 14ers a while back. I just gave it up because I got tired of the summit talk.
Yeah.
You know, it's how many of you climbed? Well, I climbed this one in a snowstorm, man. And you know, yeah. I thought, oh, wait a minute. That's not why we're here. We're here because we love these mountains. We love the experience, you know. And I started climbing 13ers. And of course, then you're all alone at the top and you have an amazing time. But I've gone back to climbing some 14ers now, but I was jaded for a little while there. And I think it might be very much related to what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I'm jaded on the 8,000 meter peaks, which just bothers me because I want to go back for myself, you know, to do these, you know, like, look, I'd love to summit Kachinjunga. Like, that would be just amazing. And I'm like, ooh, do I really have it in me to go back to a base camp on an 8,000 meter peak? You know, it's just not what it used to be. I mean, like, great that you have nonstop internet in base camp, and great that you have a DVD, you know, not even a DVD player anymore, but, you know, like, you know, televisions in your tent. I'm like, I don't know. I guess I certainly just let everybody know how old I am.
Bentgate Mountaineering, located in Golden, Colorado, has been outfitting backcountry travelers for more than 20 years. The snow is melting and the crags are drying out. Time to break out the hiking boots, rock climbing shoes, and tents. Gear materials and designs are more evolved than ever. From the latest ultralight gear to the tried-and-true classics, Bentgate has the premier brands for climbing, hiking, and camping essentials, including Arc'teryx, Hilleberg, Nemo, Western Mountaineering, and many more. Need advice on destinations, getting started, or on fine-tuning your quiver of gear? The Bentgate staff are all passionate adventurers who can give you the data and advice you need. Bentgate is also hosting numerous events and speakers this summer, so please check out their events page at bentgate.com for more information, as well as to see their full product selection.
Have you heard of the Siowai Iris 4G Action Camera? It's Adventure Sport's first always-connected camera using mobile 4G LTE networks. Push a single button and you kick off a live stream to your friends, family, and fans so they can join you on your crazy adventures. See for yourself how it works. Visit live.siowai.com and sign up for free. Follow some of their professional mountain bikers, skimboarders, motocross riders, and of course adventurers, and join in on the fun as it happens. That's live.siowai.com.
Well, let's rewind a little bit and say uh-huh. that you're on a giant peak, but this time yep. it's like the good old days and you're not fighting the mad throngs to the top. Now we're talking about the reason that you climb it, you know, the purity yep. of the climb itself. What is that like?
You know, I think it goes back to that romanticism comment. I mean, like I was just in Alaska, you know, a week and a half ago with a guy named George Lowe. So George Lowe is 71 years old. He put up a new route on the Kangshung face on Everest back in the mid 80s. You know, he was a guy I grew up reading about, so quite a hero for me. And, you know, we just decided we want to go climbing together. And we just didn't really matter what we climbed. We just wanted to go be with each other. And we chose this peak in Alaska called Peak 11300 in the Ruth Gorge. And oh my God, every step was gorgeous. Like the sky was a crystal blue color and the ice and the rock was just so, I don't know, it was just so pretty. It was a kind of just a powerful aesthetic experience shared with somebody that you have so much respect for. And we got stuck at one point. It literally was too hot to keep climbing. The snow, we had to go across these double corniced ridges and up this super steep snowfield. And we just, you know, like literally couldn't hold our body weight. So we had to wait for it to freeze up again. So we carved a ledge about the size of, I don't know, like a, maybe 18 inches deep and about 4 feet wide. And we sat on it butt to butt cheek and pulled out a stove and started melting water and making cocoa and drinking coffee and just telling stories, you know, like what's it like to be a dad and what's it like to climb the Kangshung face on Everest. And it was just like amazing experience. And it was all about, you know, who you climbed with, not what you climbed. And that's just pure mountaineering to me. The aesthetic, like the setting is so powerful that it makes the relationship better.
Right. Yeah, I get that totally. It seems like when you are doing any adventure sport and there's a common interest and people get pulled out of the daily grind, and then the things that seem to matter in life, they percolate to the surface.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
But I can especially see that in your experiences on these mountains, just because of the challenge, the difficulties involved, as well as the setting, such a pure place.
Yeah, and you know, you're really in a lot of those situations, you're demanding that your best person is there all the time. And when you build, you know, when you build a great team, you help each other become your best person. So when things go bad, like they have had on almost every single 8,000-meter peak I've ever been on, you know that you and your buddies are going to be there for other people. And whether you're, you know, rescuing strangers, you know, getting them CPR, trying to keep them alive, or, you know, helping guide people down through a blizzard, whatever it happens to be. I mean, these are really powerful, humbling experiences that should make you a better person when you go home. And can I tell you a story?
Oh, please. You bet.
So my favorite story of mountaineering is about a guy named Willie Unsold. So do you know who Willie Unsold is?
I don't. Educate me.
Okay, so Willie Unsold was a famous mountaineer in the Tetons, etc. And in 1963, he gets invited on the first American Everest expedition. So Willie Unsold is hiking in towards base camp. And, of course, he's not alone. There's roughly 30 climbers on the expedition. And the expedition's objective, is to summit the peak. And the best way to get to the summit of Mount Everest is to follow the path of, you know, Tenzing Norgay and, you know, his gang, you know, when they summited in 1953. The Indians had been up after that. So the Americans are trying to make the third ascent of Everest. And Willie and a guy named Tom Hornbean start saying, well, why are we following the known path? Like, can't we do better than that? Can't we go on an adventure instead on Mount Everest? So they convince the leadership to allow them to have a tiny amount of resources and to attempt the west ridge of Mount Everest and to do a complete traverse of the peak, which they are successful at. When they get to the summit, it's late in the day. They run into two climbers who come up the normal route. And so the four of them are trying to descend together. They get trapped behind a rock. Willie's partner's feet are getting cold. Willie takes his boots off, the man's boots off, and puts them on his chest and rubs his feet all night long to keep them from getting frostbitten. And when he stands up in the morning, he realizes that his feet are frostbitten. So he comes home, they amputate, you know, a bunch of his toes, etc. He has a bunch of kids. He has his beautiful daughter. He names her Nanda Devi after the sacred peak in India. And when Nanda Devi is in her 20s, she tells her dad, you know, like, come on, Dad, why don't you lead an expedition to Nanda Devi? We could make the first American ascent to this peak. And so Willie Unsold gets the best climbers in America at the time, and they travel to northern India. And as they're walking into base camp, this shaman comes up to Nanda Devi, the beautiful daughter with the long blonde hair, and clearly nobody in this part of the world had ever seen a, you know, a young blonde woman walking through their villages before. And he goes, I know why you're here. You're the reincarnation of the goddess Nanda, the goddess of joy, and you've come here to die.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, they go on to the mountain. The first team succeeds in reaching the summit. Nanda Devi's in high camp getting ready to go to the top. And a storm blows in, and they're trapped in this tent. And by the time the storm is over, Nanda Devi is dead.
Wow.
So Willie comes back to the United States, and he's interviewed by the press. And they're like, Willie, you've had the greatest achievement of an American in mountaineering, you know, going up the west ridge of Everest, doing the first complete traverse of the peak. And now you've had the greatest loss that anybody could ever experience. But your team did get to the summit. So was this expedition a success or a failure? And Willie said, an expedition is a success not because you reach the summit. An expedition is a success only if you learn something about yourself on the trip and you apply it to life back at home. And that, to me, has always been my philosophy in mountaineering. You know, like, can we go there no matter what happens? Can we learn something about ourselves and make the rest of our lives better as a result?
Oh, yeah. Well said.
Yeah. Well, gotta love Willie.
Yeah. You know, it's a heart-wrenching story, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we both have daughters.
Right. Yeah. I think, you know, my wife enjoys the safer climbing, right? But she always questions the really big mountains because of the risks involved, and she always asks the question, is it worth it? But, you know, I want to bring in the fact that as I was going through some of your bio information, I see time and time again that you were turned back on a mountain when other parties got in trouble, or you rescued these other parties when they got in trouble. And there are so many attempts where you didn't summit, but you came back. And when so many others didn't, or you helped others to come back who wouldn't have made it otherwise, tell us about that.
Well, okay. In mountaineering, there's pouting, right? It's so obvious if you have succeeded or failed by a quantitative measure, right? Did you get to the highest point or not? So I've turned back within, you know, 200 or 300 feet of 8,000 meter peaks at least three times, certainly within 1,000 feet, a number of times. And each time I grieved over that, you know, like I kicked rocks all the way down the moraine, you know, and pouted until I got back home. But that wasn't reason enough to not do the right thing. And let me just tell you a different story to kind of make this point a little more. So in, I think it was 2012, there was a British woman who was trying to become the youngest British woman to reach the summit of Mount Everest. So she's climbing with her dad, six Sherpas, and 344 other knuckleheads trying to get to the top. So she summits the peak. She gets back home. She's interviewed by the papers, and they say to her, was there anything, you know, like, that was super cool you got to the top. Was there anything disappointing that happened along the way? And she said, yeah. She goes, it was terribly disappointing to have to step over a dying person to reach the top. Oh. And the reporter stops, like, what are you talking about? And she goes, oh, yeah, this guy, you know, was coming down from the summit, having summited the day before, overcome by exhaustion. He sits down. He's, you know, slowly freezing to death. As we passed him, he sat up and asked for help. But myself, my dad, our Sherpas, and 344 other people decided that the summit was more important. You know, and she didn't exactly say that part of the words because she was clearly embarrassed for having stepped over this guy. But, like, if we can't be proud of ourselves after the accomplishment, that, you know, that just tells the whole story, that it wasn't an accomplishment. Like, if we put accomplishments over partnerships, then we're in real big trouble. Like, on your deathbed, you want to be surrounded by friends, not trophies.
Absolutely.
So we, you know, what's most important to me is partnership. I'm feeling pretty damn satisfied on the accomplishment side.
Right. Yeah. You know, I had a friend who invited me and another of his friends to go do some 14ers together. And so we did. This is just a really simple story compared to that. But he took off and left his other friend behind several times. And I started hanging back with the other guy thinking, wow, this is kind of a weird situation.
Yeah.
And we were trying to do a traverse between two 14ers. And it got pretty sketchy. You know, we weren't roped, and there was a lot of exposure. And his friend just obviously wasn't experienced enough for it. Grown man started crying. You know, it's one of those moments where, okay, he's reached his limit, and this is no longer fun. And the guy who invited him was angry because I said, all right, it's time to turn around.
Wow, yeah.
You know, and it was like we ruined his trip.
Yeah.
I just thought, wow, really? And the thing that I got out of that was, number one, I'm not climbing with him again.
Yeah.
You know, that's ridiculous. Number two, it's just exactly what you said. You know, we could have left that situation stronger brothers than before.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what
so,
I mean?
So I do know what you mean. So we, I do tons of work with, you know, the coolest teams you could ever imagine, from covert ops teams to special ops teams to professional sports teams to Fortune 100 companies. And, you know, when we analyze how people judge us and how we judge people, we really judge everybody on two axes. So did we deliver strategic results, and are we aligned with our core values? So this friend of yours, you know, the one climber, was clearly thought that what was most important was strategic results.
Right.
And then for you, what was most important, obviously, was, you know, are we aligned on our core values?
Correct.
And in a perfect world, we're always going to surround ourselves who deliver strategic results and are aligned with our core values. And, you know, that's who we want to be. You know, the person that people can count on to deliver the results and are, you know, passionate and humble in the process. You know, that we could, they are trustworthy. They care about us.
Yeah, very well said. I couldn't agree with that more either. I seek out people that share those core values, and I'll even opt for that over the results, you know.
Yeah.
Because in the end, it's the brotherhood, it's the sisterhood that really makes the difference.
Well, it's funny being in businesses all the time because, you know, I'll tell them the story of climbing K2 and all the crazy stuff that happens along the way, which is all sorts of, you know, like extreme levels of selfishness versus, you know, these powerful examples of heroism, et cetera, that go on in the story. And then I ask people to make judgments of people, and almost everybody comes away with that it's putting more weight on the core values than they do on the results part. You're like, oh, I would never climb with a team. But wait, that team got 75% of the people to the summit. Yeah, but they were jerks.
<You know? laughs> Right.
Like, I'd rather climb with that other team than they got 33% of the people to the summit. You're like, so, yeah, I think there's a, yeah, most of us, I think, weight that core values thing over anything else.
You know what? And we should. I think about an infant or a young child who's beginning to learn to walk, right?
Mm-hmm.
They fall down over and over and over again, and we pick them back up and say, try again, and they get lots of encouragement. And in the end, we all end up walking, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's kind of ingrained in our nature that to fail is a part of the learning experience, right? But if we become selfish along the way, then what have we accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, now we can get really deeply philosophical because yes, to a point, and then the narrative changes. And I think the best thing that's happening in business right now is that people are more accepting of failure than they were, you know, 10 and 15 years ago, and certainly, you know, 30 years ago. And that's actually a result, I think, why, you know, we have so much more innovation now than we did, you know, 100 years ago.
Sure. Yeah. Well, speaking of business, you know, you built a climbing career that was just amazing. And you've also guided all of these trips, which is, you know, a part of the business. You've built up Earth Treks, which is, by the way, folks, if you've not been to an Earth Treks, you got to go. Best climbing gyms I've ever been to, and I've been to a lot of them. But what was it like to be doing all of these things in parallel here? I mean, were the challenges of building up the business kind of a parallel to the challenges you saw in the peaks?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We are completely. I would have never, I absolutely did not have the courage to start my own business. And a coworker sat me down and said, for somebody who takes, you know, I just had come back from doing a new route in the winter, you know, on some peak in Nepal. And this guy's like, for somebody who takes so much risk with your personal lives, why won't you take one with your professional life? And it was like a light bulb went off. And I was, you know, I found out to be a fraud. I'm like, okay, you're right. I have no excuse not to take everything I learned in the mountains and turn it into a business. And, you know, we spent a lot of time analyzing what makes a great mountaineering team. And to simplify it, I'll just tell you there's four main characteristics of any great team. And number one is that people are so passionate about the mission that they will put the mission of the organization ahead of their personal desires. And that passion is contagious, right? It creates opportunity for success, even in under-resourced organizations. The second thing is you have to know where you're going, and you have to communicate that to people. And in mountaineering, like every step higher you get, the further you could see on the horizon, the more data you collect, you can make a better and better decision. And you might climb up 2,000 feet to realize you better get down again, you know, because now you're seeing storms build up or, you know, it's taking you too long, whatever it happens to be. So being passionate, being able to craft and communicate a dynamic vision, and then it's the ability to build partnerships. And, you know, the two most important words in any partnership are trust and caring. And it's critical that we are worthy of people's trust, that we entrust other people, that we spend tons of time showing people that we care for them so they can do their best work. And the last part of this whole little recipe is perseverance. And, you know, it's not good enough just to work hard. And most, you know, people in corporations these days, you know, they're just in the asteroid belt. They're working their little tuchuses off. But we really have to learn from sports teams and, you know, covert ops teams, et cetera, that it's really not just hard work, but it's smart work. And so our stopping and talking and reflecting upon what we've just gone through to learn from it is critical for our future success. So, you know, if there's four things that are critical to being a successful mountaineering team, is that everybody has to be ridiculously passionate. Otherwise, you're just not going to go through the suffering that it takes. You know, you have to have a vision of where you're going. Like quite often, you know, you're creating a new route, right? So you're envisioning what's possible and solving all the problems along the way and preparing for those problems so that you have the right equipment with you. And your partnership, like, man, when things are really scary, if you don't trust your belayer, you're not going to be able to do the hard moves. And, you know, lastly, that perseverance thing, like it's going to take a lot of hard work, you know? So, yeah, those four things combined make for a great business and a great mountaineering team.
You know, I think that's great advice for almost any endeavor. Holy cow.
Yeah. Well, you know, Kurt, that's why I get paid the big bucks to go into big corporations and tell them how to fix themselves.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, you're a keynote speaker and an author. If people want to sign you up as a keynote speaker, then how do they get in touch with you?
Well, the best thing to do is first visit my website, which is chrisbwarner.com. So Chris is in boywarner.com. And you can just Google me, Chris Warner Climber. But there's a lot of stuff about the kind of work I do, the kind of groups that I work best with. And yeah, there's videos on me of speaking to groups. There's a, you know, we filmed our K2 expedition for NBC, and we were actually nominated for 6 Emmys. Got to go to the Emmys, which is pretty cool. We didn't win. So, but that was still fine. Anyway, that whole movie is, there's a link on there to that movie. So if people want to sit back one day and watch what it's like to climb K2, they can do that.
Very cool. And let's talk about your book a little bit here. High Altitude Leadership. That book is ranking really well on the charts too.
Thanks. I'm really pleased. You know, like I was approached by my co-author to do this book with him, and I thought of it like a marathon. Like, can you run a marathon? Like, if you've never run a marathon, if you've ever climbed a big peak before, you have this, you know, question in your mind, is it even possible? So, you know, we pulled it off. Luckily, it's had a really, really powerful shelf life. I've had so many people call me over the years and saying how it's changed their life. I mean, you know, it's kind of scary when people call you up and say, hey, I read your book and then quit my job. Well, you're not sleeping in my basement. it's a nice, honorable experience to have written a book that has so much traction and has opened so many doors for me.
Sure. Well, just so people kind of get a parameter for the book, who does this resonate with? Who's the target audience?
Well, it really was originally written as a business book. And what we did was we kind of took the metaphor, like, so when I was guiding Everest, we used to tell people there's 19 ways that you can die on summit day. And you need to know those 19 forms of death. So if you see them coming towards you, you can, you know, turn around and go back home.
Right.
And we took the same approach to looking at how teams, what causes failure in teams. And we identified 8 categories of failure. And then we really try to use the book as a way to teach people how to recognize these ways that teams fail so that they can, you know, correct and not die. And it was cool. Like I think one of the things that makes it really fun is every chapter is really based around a mountaineering story. So, you know, there you are hanging by a fingertip and this thing happens. And, you know, we explore this thing kind of from a scientific basis, you know, and then hopefully the people live, you know, in the mountaineering part of it. So, and there's pictures. So even if you're a terrible reader, there's great pictures.
Well, I'm going to have to get a copy of it and go through that one. That sounds really, really good.
Yeah, you can. It's on Amazon. It's, you know, it's simple to find.
Okay, High Altitude Leadership. Yep. Got it. And your co-author's name?
Don Schmanka.
Don Schmanka. Okay.
And we met on a mountaineering expedition. He was a client of mine. We were doing a fundraiser for cancer, and he was a participant.
Right on.
Yeah.
Do you love mountains? You are not alone. Jerry Roach is well known for his extraordinary and detailed guidebook, Colorado 14ers. But did you know that Jerry has written 15 books, including guidebooks to 13ers, Indian Peaks, Rocky Mountain National Park, and more? But he has also written narratives about a lifetime of mountaineering full of Jerry's insights and humor. If you like adventure, then these books are for you. Jerry Roach's books can be purchased at his website, summitsight.com. That's SUMMITSIGHT.com, as well as on Amazon and in bookstores near you. Well, let's think about the listener who hasn't done climbing, who says, man, that sounds appealing, but I don't even know where to start. What advice do you have for somebody?
Well, now it's really simple, right? Go indoors. And you and I both climb indoors. We love climbing outdoors. The coolest thing about the indoor climbing scene is that it's a community of people that you will resonate with. And you'll be kind of just sucked up into their powerful energy. And, you know, of course, the classes are great and the skill development, et cetera. But it's, you know, it's a very accessible way to get into climbing. And it's, you'll find out that climbing is much more than you thought, you know, in the sense of this gigantic community of people that are doing super cool stuff. And, you know, you get to be friends with all these people and you inspire them and they inspire you. So I would check out your local climbing gym.
Well, that's good. So what are the benefits of climbing? And climbing indoors specifically, I like to bring it up because it's a lot easier to get to the indoor gym on a regular basis and there are benefits to that. But what are the benefits to climbing in general?
Well, Well, I mean, I think there's a billion, right? So there's obviously the physical aspects. You know, it's a great whole body workout. It's great for increasing your flexibility. It's a great intellectual challenge. I mean, every climb is a challenge. It's a problem that has to be solved. It's a great emotional, place to, improve because you're confronting real things like real fear, like real opportunities for failure, et cetera. And, it requires that you develop trusting relationships with your belayer. So there's a lot of emotional aspects that come of it. Then if you take it away from home, like the further away from home, it's a great excuse to go explore new parts of the world, to meet people you would have never met before. So it's kind of hard to say, I think there's a for people who've been climbing for 50 plus years, there's still things that they benefit from.
Oh yeah, no doubt. You know, Chris, years ago back in Oklahoma, there was a program there where kids who got into trouble with the courts, instead of going to some juvenile delinquent center, they would go to a program that tried to equip them with some skills for life, just call it that way.
Yeah.
And a buddy and I had the great opportunity to grab some of these kids and to take them out and teach them how to rappel.
Uh-huh.
So there was a 120-foot bluff, and we would just teach kids how to rappel on this bluff. And I've brought it up on the show before, but it so impacted my life. It was fun, of course, to be at the top and to try to encourage someone to take that first step over the edge and actually go down. But to be at the bottom when they actually reach the bottom and to see the look in their eye when they have overcome something that maybe they thought they would never be able to do. They learned something that's fundamental about themselves, about what they're capable of and their own character. And to see these kids, a lot of them with this huge facade and chip on their shoulder and, I'm the tough guy, just at the bottom, get real, The joy that you saw in their faces just because they overcame a challenge. And I have to throw that in there as well. Not everybody has that much of a challenge to do a rappel or to climb in an indoor gym, but the people that are finding their challenges and overcoming them, it's just such an amazing experience.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of our, understanding of what makes human beings so cool is, that they seek out these, learning experiences, and as a result, they hopefully become better people.
Sure.
And then give something back to the next person, the next person, next person. So.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Earth Treks. We touched on it, but there are a lot of people out there that have never been to a climbing gym. So if they walk in the door, what are they going to find there?
Well, climbing gyms have really changed. When we first got in the business back in the mid-90s, they were really clubhouses for climbers. So, you found painted plywood with plastic holes bolted to the wall, and, it was they were super cool places, for their times. Now, it's changed so much. I mean, now they're, premier health clubs, and there's fitness rooms and pro shops and, really nice bathrooms and yoga studios that are all inside this climbing community.
Yeah. Describe the route system that you would have in a typical gym so people can get a feel for the variety of things that are there.
Yeah. So the cool thing about a climbing gym is that you constantly change the route. So the climb that goes up the wall, in our gyms on the rope climbing, for instance, it's generally about a 10-week to 12-week turnaround time. So every, 10 to 12 weeks, the climbs are stripped and then new ones are put up, and it's a constant rotation. So, the route setters, it's a very physical form of artistry, and they are trying to help your body move in a way that's going to, just get you really fired up to be a person, like the way that they make you twist and turn and, pull and push to get to the top. So that's a real, I think one of the better things that have come out of climbing in the last 20 years is just becoming more artistic in the route setting. And with that then comes the need for more artistic shaped handholds and footholds. And it creates more of a visual effect now when you come in. So there's a lot of, think of a climbing gym as a five-star restaurant, and there are subtle things that are done in a five-star restaurant to make you enjoy the food. It's the lighting that goes into it. It's the service that goes into it. It's the, the crispness of your napkin, the shine of your fork and knife. So there's lots of pieces that make up you know, the experience that really, I think to somebody who's never been in one before, it might take them a while to pick up on, you know, what's the source of the magic or why is this place a little bit more magical than that place?
Yeah. Well, I know that the Earth Treks in Golden, where I climb, it's just delightful. I mean, every time you choose a route you haven't done, you can choose a difficulty level, but mm-hmm. as you're trying to go up the route, there's always a problem. There's a crux, you know, there's something there.
Yeah.
How do you do that? And you got to figure it out physically and mentally before you're mm-hmm. going to be able to pull it off. And that's part of the challenge of it that I think is really fun. Not to mention the great workout and the sheer joy of getting
yeah.
up. You know?
And it's shared, right? That's the difference between like a normal, like if you go to, you get on a treadmill in a gym, which is, you know, super cool form of exercise, but it's an individual activity.
Right.
And even in what we call bouldering, which is where you're climbing without a partner, you don't have a rope, you're generally doing it as part of a group. You know, there's a group of people bouldering. And so you're, you know, hoping for the best for the other person. You're giving them advice. You know, you're just more engaged with people when you climb as fitness than just about anything else as fitness.
Oh yeah. And it's cool too, just to sit and watch people climb to see how they solve the problem. And you see
yeah.
people do stuff. It's like, wow, now that was a creative solution. That was amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, people might think we're just talking about, you know, getting up some challenge on a wall, but no, there's a lot of energy there. A lot of neat stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't have TVs in our fitness rooms. So like if you're on the treadmill for, you know, whatever you're hour workout, you're looking through a window at climbers. And I had a customer one time send me an email, and she said, you know, at first I was really angry that you didn't have television. She's like, I came there to get my cardio workout. You know, I wanted to watch CNN. And then it dawned on me that I was watching something so much better. I was just watching humanity. And she went on and like the best poetry ever to describe, you know, what it was like to just watch, you know, dads climbing with daughters and, you know, boyfriends climbing with girlfriends and, you know, 65-year-old men and women, you know, like meeting after work to hang out with each other. And I was like, you got it. Like,
that's it.
Right? Why
cool.
are you running but to be a member of that community?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, very fun.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, we're running a little bit short on time, but would you close us out with a story about climbing on a mountain somewhere that has been an inspiration to you, and maybe it'll be inspiration to the rest of us?
Okay, but you realize I'm the worst marketer for the sport of mountaineering, right?
Okay.
Okay, so we're in northern India on a peak called Shivling, which is 21,500 feet tall, and we get caught in a blizzard.
Mm.
And the blizzard hits us. It's almost like a wall of blizzard hits us, and we're, you know, 5,000 feet up this peak. And we have no choice but to rappel down to the last flat spot that we saw, which is half the size of your kitchen table. So there's room on this top for two of us to lay there, curled in the fetal position. But not, you can't put up a tent because there's no room for a tent. The third guy, which is me, I found a flake of rock peeled away from this main pedestal. And I put my feet between the flake of rock and laid on this kind of snow that was blown in there. And the blizzard starts to rage, and it doesn't stop. It goes on for a full day. It goes on for the next night. Goes into the next day, into the next night. Somewhere along the lines, one of the guys on the upper ledge, as he rolled over, knocks the cook pot off the ledge.
Oh, no.
So now we have no way to melt snow into water to rehydrate our dehydrated food. Eventually, the blizzard ends, and we want to descend, but the avalanche danger is too great. Literally, the mountain is just peeling layer and layer of ice and snow off of it.
Wow.
And we have no choice but to go up and over the mountain. And we know we need to drink. We haven't eaten or drinking in days, and we have this piece of tinfoil that we were able to melt a half a cup of water for each person. And we each eat a single Twix bar and leave and start climbing at 8 o'clock in the morning. Well, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, so almost 24 hours later, we're still climbing. And we get underneath this gigantic overhang of snow. And it's what's it called, a cornice, like a giant wave of frozen snow. And I literally have to tunnel directly up through this cornice. So it was like coming out of a manhole cover. And it was about 15 feet of tunneling straight up to get to the point where I could pop my head up. And we pop up onto this big snowy ridgeline. And it's the first time that we can sit down in, you know, since the storm. And so we sit down, the three of us together, and we're looking at each other. We're completely overcome by exhaustion. and we make a decision, or we have to make a decision. Do we continue to go to the summit, or do we get the heck off this thing by going down the mountain by a path that we've never, like in a way we've never seen, to drop into a valley we've never been into before, but it's the only way to get off this peak. And we actually decided to continue going to the top for some stupid reason. We're unable to get there because the technical difficulty is too great. So we're stopped 50 feet short of the summit. And we now start to descend. And as we're doing rappel after rappel after rappel, on the sixth rappel, I'm the last guy to go. And as I lean back on the anchor pops. And I'm now flying through the air. And I fell 450 feet through the air and slammed into the side of the mountain, caused an avalanche, bounced out another 50 feet, was buried like a dart in the steep snow, and then the avalanche hit me. And by a miracle, it did not knock me off the peak. Well, my two climate partners, you know, down climbed to me. They checked me out, the whole thing. And we still have like 3,000 feet of climbing to descend. And it takes us another day and a half to get off the peak. And I walked away from that mountain with a tiny scratch on my nose, even though having fallen, you know, a total of 500 feet.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but I had severe psychological damage. To this day, I don't like rappelling.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing that anyone can fall that kind of a distance and survive, but the landing worked out.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, stuck the landing, man.
Oh, wow.
I just felt I was not fated to die that day. So that day was September 17th, 1989. So September 17th, 1999, I'm on this giant peak in Tibet, and it starts to snow, and we start to descend, and I get caught in an avalanche, and I'm pulled. Luckily, I was connected to a rope, and I ended up getting pulled down for a couple hundred feet. The rope never snapped, and eventually I was swept to the side of the avalanche. I was buried up to my neck. And it was exactly 10 years to the day after I was killed in India. So September 17th, 2009 comes around, and I stayed in my house on the couch all day.
I was going to say, is it your lucky day or your unlucky day?
I think it was my unlucky day, man. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you're right. That doesn't sell me on big mountain climbing necessarily, but it's a great story.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, yeah, Chris, crazy stuff happens out there.
One more time, how can people find you?
You know, I'd suggest I'd go to both to the Earth Treks website and look up Chris Warner Climber on Google, and you could find my speaking website. You know, that's the best source for stuff like the, you know, the television shows and all the other stuff that I was involved with.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today and for being on the Adventure Sports Podcast. It's a real honor, and it's been a ball.
Well, thanks, Kurt. Thanks for inviting me. This is great work you're doing.
All right. Thank you. And to all of our listeners out there, you don't have to summit at 8,000 meter peak to get out there and have some fun.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.